Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Zion Experience, or as we call it, the TZE. We're glad to have you. If you're a returning listener, thank you for spending some time with us. If you're new to the show, welcome. I'm your co-host, Jim Shaw, and I've got Drew Eubank, my partner in crime, with me today. Jordan's off today, and so Drew and I are taking care of this version of the episode. And if you are joining us for the first time, wherever you're listening, just go out and hit the subscribe button. We release episodes, try to release them about every other week. And we have some of the most interesting people in supply chain that we come on, and we just have an interesting conversation, very casual conversation. And I think we cover some really cool topics. We talk about robots. We're going to talk about some logistics and how to run operations today. And we get to talk to some of the best people in the industry, and today's no different. So today's topic of the episode is the global supply chain. And we've got a special guest on that I'm going to turn it over to Drew and let him introduce. And we're just glad to have you. So sit back and listen and enjoy.
So yeah, it's my honor to introduce Christine Fleckel. Christine, I'm going to let you give your own introduction, but thank you so much for joining us. It's hard to believe we broke bread almost 2 years ago in Raleigh at the Greek restaurant. And I still remember it's one of my favorite Greek restaurants. So thank you so much for joining us. If you don't mind giving an introduction about your background and just who Christine is.
Yeah, sounds good, Drew. And I remember that restaurant too. I've been there a few times after. Always some good food and always good to break bread with partners. But yeah, Christine Fleckel, I'm currently the SVP of Global Supply Chain for FCP Euro, a global automotive aftermarket parts supplier that focuses on European makes. One of the founders in that segment of e-com aftermarket. But my background's been supply chain for many years and different facets, from working in the 3PL world way back in the day to consumer electronics, running sites, locations, to use books, running end-to-end in different kinds of high volume, 4 million SKU count type situations, to being at Harry's Inc. for 5 years prior to this role, in the CPG space, e-com and retail, you know, growing business there. And then joining FCP about 2 years ago, similar timing to when I met y'all at Zion, you know, building out and solidifying the end-to-end supply chain here. Love it. Different problems every day. And when I'm not doing that, I'm an avid sports memorabilia card collector. And I also race mountain bikes, which is a new hobby later in life, but a super fun one. I think it's my midlife crisis or stress relief, either or, but it's really fun and keeps me going when I'm not trying to solve some problems out there.
You know, ironically enough, Christine, if you want to do sports memorabilia, I know you played softball, if I'm not mistaken, in D.C. State, right? And my son's playing baseball now. Who knows how good he's going to be? He's about to turn 13, but we went to Cooperstown. And in Cooperstown, there's probably 7 memorabilia stores to everything else. There's not many stores, probably like 50 total. And there's probably 30 memorabilia stores. You can walk in and find anything you want, any signed ball, poster, whether it's mostly baseball, of course, right? But, I mean, there's movie store stuff. There's basketball stuff. It was – if the 8-year-old me who collected sports cards and that type of thing for so many years would have been in heaven if I had unlimited funds up there. And I made the mistake of telling my son that if he did something exceptional, he could assign autograph something. And he had an exceptional weekend. So it was a very expensive trip to Cooper.
Well, that's awesome for your son, Drew. And it is supply chain related. It's very interesting. And this may age me, but when I was, to your point, 8-year-old, 10-year-old Christine, cards were like a dime a dozen. And there was just a ton of every player, and you'd get your favorite player and you get really excited. Today, that has changed. And the way cards work, especially, you know, there's cards selling for millions of dollars. There's celebrities driving up the demand. There's boxes of cards that are hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like the normal everyday collector gets boxed out, and the community found creative ways to deal with it, kind of like supply chain, find it very creative ways to split costs, to get people into it and do that. So it's a, I like it. It's a, not the cheapest hobby, but at the end of the day, I'm a sports junkie too. So it kind of gets you more into the season. You learn about people that you wouldn't normally follow. And, you know, just generally, there's a pretty good community of folks out there doing the same thing. So.
So I think we're very in tune with the challenges you have at FCP and how you're changing the global supply chain there. But with your experience, what's been the, what's your passion that's driven you to be focused in this area? Like what's excites you about it every day when you wake up?
You know, that's a great question. And I didn't go to school for this. I kind of just jumped in it from, you know, driving a forklift, a job after college that I needed with a friend. And we were importing clothes for Walmart. And it was very interesting, the whys of why companies buy overseas, why they import, how they store, how they move things around. And then over time, I started to tie all this back to the customer dynamic. And what drives me here is the supply chain is constantly working to enable solutions to better serve a changing customer dynamic. So it's two-faceted, multifaceted there. So you have to understand the, what's happening in the greater world, geopolitical, economical, everything, and really understand customer behavior and then design solutions. And it's moving so fast that there's new problems to solve every day on both fronts. And I think that's what makes it really interesting to me. And then the second part is the people. You know, when I was younger, I'll be very open and honest, I was pretty shy. I was nervous when, you know, leading people, I struggled with it. And then something one day clicked and I really like it. I really like empowering people, teaching people, seeing really smart people, put them in a room, come together and drive powerful solutions that you can never think of on their own. And I think that's what drives me every day. I know that was a bit verbose answer and wasn't necessarily super direct to the question, but it's all of that in one. That, you know, keeps me interested and helps me get out of bed every morning and get excited most days.
No, I had a similar experience as I didn't go to school for this either. Right now, the leadership side, I went to school for that. So for me, that was the human interaction's a big deal. So you've now been in a couple growing, scaling e-com companies, right? Where consumer demand's going to shift mightily with the way the economic segment hits. It hits everybody, but when you're direct to consumer, you're right there at the pocketbook. What have you seen has been the biggest challenge? And then what's been the most exciting part of working in that specific sector for you?
That's great. A great question. I think the biggest challenge is, I hate to say it because everybody says it, it's the Amazon effect. It's balancing delivery service and cost and customer need. I think there is right now, and there has been for a while, this kind of view that, you know, the Amazon effect, everybody wants their product in one day, 2 day, and they don't dive deep enough to say, okay, do they really need that product in 1 day, 2 day? Like, go back to my time at Harry's and we did this work, so I'm really okay to say it, but you think about razor blades versus soap or body wash. Well, razor blades, you could put off a day or two. Body wash, if you don't get your order on time or very quickly, you're going to go to the store and get it. You can't smell bad, right? Like, maybe you can, I don't know, but prefer not to, right? So trying to balance that, I think is really important. I think no one has figured it out perfectly yet. I think there's a lot more optimization to happen in that space. And also the dynamic is changing too. You know, e-com, a lot of e-com companies aren't profitable, right? Like that's the reality. I'm not saying that's, you know, a lot of the folks that came out in the last few years, well, go back a couple, but like the last, you know, 7 to 10 were not. And it's expensive. And how do you balance e-com, the cost to serve, doing that well, with growing business too and meeting the customer where they're at. You know, a lot of customers use e-com as a testing ground too, and not necessarily like a full-time place to purchase. So that's something else. It's just an interesting customer base that is ever changing right now with all the options out there. And there's still a lot of optimization, I think, that needs to happen in the e-com space overall.
What would you say the biggest difference? I mean, other than in the States, we are more e-com focused, right? Our volume of purchase through e-commerce channels is higher than places else on the globe. On a global scale, though, have you seen any similarities or vast differences in order behaviors and that consumer behavior from an e-com channel perspective?
I would say there's some areas of the globe that are definitely driving more e-com purchases than others. Australia's big. Canada has their own problems. If you're right over the border in those very dense cities, very e-com friendly, buying a lot of stuff. A lot of the European countries are starting to drive some good e-com volume. Germany, Spain in particular, but they do e-com different. They do a lot more click and collect versus to your door, but it also ties into their way of life. A lot more walking, a lot more stuff like that. The same in the UK. It's very prevalent there, but there are other areas that are just not, and some it's due to payment, lack of infrastructure, and just bigger barriers to entry, but it's coming and it's going to continue to grow. There's no doubt about it. People are integrated to a digital landscape much earlier on in their life cycle. It's part of the school system. It's part of everything. And that's not only in the US. So building that infrastructure on a global basis and figuring out how to do it and solve for those challenges that are there is still real and it's still a big opportunity.
So today you're an auto and you're dealing with high-end auto aftermarket. What's the behavior difference for those folks who are literally just tinkering with their toys, or they're building something special in their garage versus... Is there a different expectation they have when they order something versus what you experienced in your past life?
It's a great question. And the answer is yes and no. So we don't do a ton of performance, more but like the tinkering and, you know, the enhancement. We do some, but we do a lot of, you know, hard parts. So a water pump, a injection coil, something like that. So people... usually when they're ordering parts like that, they need it. So the expectation is there. You'll see the people who 100% want the expedited shipping. But you'll also see a demographic who doesn't, who has multiple vehicles, who is a weekend warrior, who's just waiting to do it on the weekend. And then you also have the maintenance customer, the oil change kit, the opportunistic folks. So it really depends on the specific customer. It's really hard to pin down that one, Drew. We're still trying to figure it out, how to optimize that, how to hit all those spots. You know, at FCP Euro, we have in our catalog over 300,000 parts and growing. And that's really hard to make sure that's there, you know, next day, same day. And a lot of them are very nuanced. We cover a ton of makes and chassis and fitments through many years. So, it's a balance of making sure you're able to get a customer the lion's share as quickly as you can, but also have access to that longer tail. But you may just not be as efficient and quick with it. And to figure out how to be quick with all of it, I think it's a cost service balance piece and understanding that and continuing to understanding that as things evolve. So convoluted answer, but we're still kind of leaning into some of it. And the long answer is it depends. It depends on the rationale for the purchase here.
Yeah. One of the things that I used to work with a lot, especially and we still see with apparel organizations, right? You have apparel organizations who have retail channel, which is good. And they have B2C and they don't have any wholesale. They're not going to outside sources to deliver their product. And I think one of the most, I won't say the name of the company, but there was a large organization who's grown over the years that when they swapped from the Amazon model to the over communication customer experience model, they saw their sales increase. In other words, I can only go here to get your stuff. It's the only place I can buy it from. The customer expectation wasn't to have it the next day because I'm buying something I want, not something I necessarily need. And just by over communicating, they completely changed the paradigm and had a better control on cost. Do you think that's something that companies lack? Is that something that can help you? Is that something that other companies can mirror? It's different with Amazon because, right, Amazon, you get anything. You get pens, cereal, milk, you get a boat, like a house. You get a house kit off of Amazon, right? It's a little different because it's competing product. But when you just have your own single source, it's a little different.
I think you can. I don't know if that works in my world, Drew, because you could go get the parts other places too. We have competitors. Amazon is not huge into auto parts. They do have some things. Like you get the oils, you get the things there. And some days it's a better, you know, it's on sale, Prime 2 days. I get an oil change kit. Like it can happen. But what you're talking about, if you are a single source of a product, especially apparel, and you have something that's customized, if you limit, you know, your distribution, I think that works really well. And you could drive some really intense demand if you know your customer well, because they don't have another option. Like you're limiting that option as well. And they feel, I believe that customer feels special and they're willing to wait. And apparel, you know, I would assume something that's customized or a specific brand, someone's willing to wait. They may not need that instant gratification. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about before. It's like that deep dive into the customer. Like, what is the need? What are they using it for? Getting those insights, understanding that, you know, if I'm going to go buy that Zion polo that you're wearing, right? Like, and I want that because it's prestigious and I'm willing to wait 10 to 14 days, even if it's like customized, has my name on it, whatever it may be. But if I need socks because I got the hole in the last pair of my socks, I'm not willing to wait. And like, I think understanding that on a SKU by SKU, brand by brand, category by category basis is the key to optimization here. My humble opinion, but that's kind of where my head goes.
Drew, I think you could really look at it. And Christine, you could say is it's really hard. How would I put this? To control the customer's behavior. You can try, but you've got, from a brand perspective, most of D2C, most of the e-commerce business is reactionary to it. And it comes back to, again, you said it. I mean, it's a real thing, the Amazon effect. If I want it today, or I think I need it today, versus delivering the behavior of you're going to get it at a certain point and you can afford to ship it when it's available or to have a more premium model to get it to them. I mean, you think about it, it's like, who wants to pay shipping on anything today? That's mm-hmm. And that's a real cost. I mean, shipping, a lot of people in the warehouse, they look at what's inside a 3PL, but the transportation of it is a huge line on the P&L. And almost everybody has collectively been forced to match some form of free shipping. And they do it in multiple unique ways, but I think modifying customer behavior is really, really a tough challenge for, it has to be a tough challenge for a brand. And it's a tough challenge to get out products, especially when you got more consumable products. Or it seems like it would be. I haven't been on that end of it. Maybe you've seen that some more, Christine, but.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Like it's staying ahead of it, and you can't control the consumer, but you could learn about them. You can meet them where they are, and you can build those solutions to blend it and customize it. And that's the cool thing about e-commerce too, because in traditional brick and mortar, you can't necessarily do that. You could do things. You could get people to get in, you know, into a specific aisle, increase their basket size, put really creative, cool stuff on there. We did it all the time at Harry's. Big dude with a razor at the end of an aisle at Walmart. It was incredible launch. Was really proud of that. But it doesn't impact your consumer. It doesn't change them.
No.
And, you know, you better be on time and full and get your product there. We all know it. And that's CPG. That's retail. And you don't have that influence. And you also don't necessarily have that direct line to your customer to understand them. And even when you look to expand that second level of the bullseye or the dartboard to say, how do we reach those guys? How do we reach that next ring and make sure we're meeting them where they want to be and providing a service that really resonates with them? So I think that's where e-com has an advantage. And thinking about it that way, in my eyes, is what differentiates a company instead of doing a one size fits all, which a lot of people pigeonhole themselves into.
Yeah.
So interesting question here, Christine, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you said, you know, you didn't go to school for this. And as we look around all of our different customers, there's very few ladies in senior positions. How do we get more interest for folks to get into the operation supply chains that are more diverse? Can we get more diversity of thought, both at an operational level and a customer, like your approach to customers is probably different because of how you view things. And just what's your perspective with that?
Man, that's a great question. You know, I want to be politically correct here. And so I want to watch how I say it, but if you still look around supply chain, you go into a DC, even my own, you know, we just don't have a ton of diversity of thought, and especially women. And auto parts is a double whammy, right? Like it's typically not something that there's a ton of equality in. Like you have your pockets, so it's harder. And I'm committed when I look at, you know, staffing, I want the diversity of thought, but I also want to hire the best person for the job. And sometimes you have to think about the interest versus the diversity piece and all that. But I'm starting to see more people. I'm starting to see more people get interested in the science and the math and solving the problems. And I think as supply chains and operations are getting more technology driven, more data driven, not as much the old, this is more of a, how do I want to put it? Like there was this view of operation supply chain that it was loading trucks, driving trucks. Like I've told people earlier in my career, you know, they ask Christine, what do you do? And I'm like, yeah, I'm head of global logistics. Oh, so you load trucks or drive trucks? I'm like, no. But sometimes it's not even worth explaining, right? Like, so it's really these typical jobs that didn't seem appealing, or at least had the view on the outside that this is what they were, and it's just hard and it's dirty and whatever. I mean, I've loaded trucks. We've all loaded trucks. I bet both of you have loaded many trucks in your day and still do it. Yep. When a customer like has a problem, and that's okay. I'm not afraid to do it. And most women I know in the industry are not either, but I think there's this perception that it was not a industry for women, and it's dirty and it's labor intensive and all that, and driving trucks. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, as a little girl, who wants to do that? Like, I think that's changing though. It's more science-based. It's more analytical. We're talking about, you know, we've had many conversations, robotics, automation, systems, efficiency, continuous improvement, supply and demand, getting this balance right, tying that into customer experience, understanding customer touch points on the logistics side. Like, It is so much more, and getting those challenges out there and bringing those challenges, you know, to light, and having more interaction at like with folks when they're in, you know, in grade school and high school, and introducing them to these types of careers and kind of showcasing it, that it's really all about problem solving and really fun problems that you can relate to. Like, I think you get more people that way. And, you know, I don't have the be all end all answer to it, but that's my thought. It's like, you have to change that perception, and get people interested and, you know, convince them why this relates to the real world and that side of the house. And,
you know, I've got a
career.
I've got the honor. We're on the supply chain board at the University of Georgia, and I go once a semester and I lecture. One of my favorite topics is to discuss that with the class, right? Because you look around, very diverse class, right? Because you got to be in there and try to just get, you know, one or two different folks who may have not been considered. They're just in the class because they got to have it for a grade, or they got to have it for, you know, degree, a requirement. And I really enjoy that conversation, the follow-up, right? One of my most exciting times is when somebody who never even thought about it before clicks a email to me and says, hey, Drew, really want to talk to you about that and get your thoughts. Because to me, that's the pay it forward aspect of what we do, right? So
Well, Drew, let me ask you a question. I kind of turn it the other way for half a second, but when you're doing that, University of Georgia, great supply chain school, really, really solid program. Have you seen more diversity start to come through the program while you're going down there?
100%. 100%. Yeah. So I started those lectures in 2018, I believe. And the difference in class between 2018 and today is astronomical. And it's not just, I think when we first started, the diversity was more in the folks who want to be on behind a computer. MIS, they were dabbling in supply chain and planning, right? They didn't think about the total operational impact, right? Because again, to your point, when you're running an on the boots on the ground, concrete operation, it's not really attractive to say, hey, come in here and work for 12 hours a day and get Jimmy, Joe, Bob, and Sue to do a job that is repeatable every day and get stuff out the door. But in the last couple of years, I've seen more and more diversity of just folks who had never considered it. They've never thought about it. They've always told, oh, be a lawyer, be a doctor, be a financial analyst, be an accountant. And now they're understanding that there's a bigger world out there that's all impacted by this. And there's a career there, not just a job. And I think it's really, I mean, just as Zion, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 teammates, I think, for the University of Georgia, about to have 5. Like we have interns, and it's been very diverse. It's been awesome for us, right? Especially from a youth impact perspective, because it's hard to imagine we're all getting older, right? There's more gray in the beard. And Jimmy's getting it too. You know, it's one of those things. So it's
I'm covering up my age with my hat right now. So yeah. I think it's important, though. I mean, it's a conversation nobody wants to have. I don't think it's only a supply chain, right? I think the supply chain in general is doing a better job of attracting talent to it. But for the longest time, it's like it was almost like you just, to your point, Christine, it's like when people think about that, when we're describing what we do today, they're like, oh, okay. And they still don't really get it. They don't understand it. They think trucks, they think trailers, they think warehouse workers, and it's so much more than that. It's to you. It's like you've hit it multiple times. Is if you enjoy solving problems, complex problems, 3D chess type problems, the supply chain's full of it. It's got it. And then the people aspect of it, I mean, there's a place for whatever type of leader you want to be. But if you want to be a C-suite leader, there's a place for it. If you just want to be on an on-the-floor leader and just have a group and more of a, you know, a lead or a manager or supervisor, there's multiple opportunities for it. And I'm a little biased. I've grown up in it. It's all I've ever done for 26 years. And Drew and I have always shared this in multiple people at Zion, but it's like you want the best talent in the room, but it's also there's value in having diversity of thought in the room. I don't really care where the diversity of thought. I probably don't have a lot of political bones in me and the right things to say sometimes. Just, you know, I grew up in a place where a human's a human and you respect a human, you give them that dignity and respect, regardless of their makeup or what they look like or anything in the general. But it's like I've always appreciated diversity of thought. And I think you have to have it to be a real rounded company, to really scale, to really grow. You've got to add those things. And so we're a big proponent of it. We bring in diversity of thought in terms of youth, not that they're young, but they're younger than us. They're at a different partner journey, which is why we've always supported an intern co-op type program. We've got some of our best talent comes out of that. You've probably met a few of them, like Jacob and Georgia Jake. We got so many Jakes. We got to nickname them, Christine, but our whole marketing and this whole podcast and everything's been run by an intern and helping us with that. And then you need that person that's been in for 10 years. You need the person that's got the wisdom and has been there and done it for 20, 30 years. And that's what collectively makes a good team and a good company, to Jimmy's opinion, right?
I'm aligned. And I think, you know, I see it too. We get set in our ways and we have our thoughts and opinions on what's right and how it works. And we need to be challenged as well. Even as a senior leader, I have no problem with someone challenging me. I want them to do it and, you know, come with data, not all, you know, from a place of like just shooting blind, but like, that's some of my favorite parts of my world and job is like playing catch ball and whiteboarding and thinking through these solutions and have you thought about this and someone coming back to me, it's fun. Absolutely. It is really fun because you're solving broad problems and having those different perspectives is really cool. So yeah, I think our ways of thinking about it are very, very aligned as companies and personally as well. So yep. Interesting topic though.
We're rolling out new core values for the team, Christine, and one of ours is better together. And I think to truly embrace that, you know, there's definitions you can put on it, but you have to be willing to open. You have to be willing to listen. You have to be willing to debate, and you have to build that culture. And I was always the young guy in it. You probably, it sounds like you started in your career, Drew. I know you did. It's like I was 18 when I started managing people on the UPS 2-day ramp. And I learned it from the concrete up. I call it being a concrete walker. It's like I learned it. I started at the very, very bottom of it, the entry level of it. And now I'm kind of on the back end of it. It's like I'm the guy that I have to make sure you sometimes have to verbalize and give permission to be like, you can challenge me. Don't look at me as I'm some title or I don't care about that. I'm a teammate. We're trying to solve a problem. We're trying to fix an issue, or we're trying to come up with a solution. And I want that. I embrace it. I want it. Drew, you're the same way. It's like, I don't want to be the guy that thinks I know it all. And because I don't, I know a lot. I've got some wisdom, I would think, after 26 years. And I've seen a lot that only you can experience when you've lived through it. You got to have those moments in life to gain that wisdom sometimes. But some people got a lot better ideas than I have. And I've always been open and embracing of like, share them. You know, don't just do it because I said do it. Then that doesn't lead to a good solution a lot of times.
Yeah, so 100%. If it's okay, Christine, we're going to shift just a little bit, right? So we're getting towards the end of the podcast, and we'd like to be more personal, have a little bit of fun. Yeah. So the toughest question anybody ever asked me is what my favorite movie is, because I'm a damn movie nerd, right? Because we didn't have cell phones and YouTube and all that stuff growing up. Our entertainment value was, you know, some video games and then movies. One, what's your favorite movie? And if you could be in one, what would you pick and why?
Oh, that is such a hard question. And when I was prepping to do this, I still didn't have an answer to it. And actually a new team member to my team asked me this question the other day. And I was like, damn, I don't know this answer. You know, there's a movie and I only like it for this one portion, but it was a good movie. It was Gattaca, and it was a long time ago. And there's this quote that, you know, they asked the guy how he did it. And he said, I didn't save anything for the way back. And I think that's, I just like the message behind that, to give it your all. And you go and you push as hard as you can and make as big of a difference. And that stuck with me. And then of course there's like Rudy. That's a great movie.
Burn the Boats.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And if I could be in a movie, well, oh, that's a really hard one. I don't know if I have the answer. It would probably be in like a Top Gun or something like that. And not for the romance, but because I just like planes. And I think being a fighter pilot would be cool as hell. And I don't want to be one of the people shot down, but I just want to be one of the people on the side flying. and having a good old time. So weird answer, but I wanted to give you my honest answer.
No, I can't answer the question I write either, because I'm a genre driven guy. The only theme I can come up with, if it has any type of mafia type background, not just mafia movies, but like mafia type background, like some type of hierarchy or something. It's just fascinating to me. The loyalty and the way the business is done, and mafia movies are always way up on my list. And I thought, you know, being in Goodfellas and being the kid that delivers like the little stuff between the stores and interacting and seeing how those people work would always be awesome. Don't want to get involved in it, because again, I don't want to get shot. I'm not that type of guy. I don't want to get picked off. But being like the shoe shine kid, right, who gets to listen to all the Goodfellas talk and how they operate, how they function and stuff, would just be fascinating. You know,
Drew, we're aligned. We both want to stay on the side. Neither one of us wants to get shot. But no, we want to be there and want to do the cool stuff and see it.
Yeah. I'd be right in the middle of it. See, I'd be okay being right in the middle of it. I'm a gladiator. I like Gladiator's one of my favorite movies.
That is a good movie.
When he just kills everybody in the little mini Coliseum, and you know, he just goes out and just they have him all by himself and he throws his sword down and asks them if they're entertained. It's like that's probably one of Russell Crowe's best performances, but it was really good.
Yeah. You saw they have another one coming out, right? Denzel's in it.
Yeah, but it's just not going to be the same.
I don't know. It's a different storyline. I kind of like it.
I'll give it the chance. But I don't know that they can be the same.
For me, again, action, just because, I mean, who doesn't like action movies? But again, there's a mafia-esque type hierarchy with the way that they were running. Like, there's the emperor and how you have to respond to the emperor. And then that again, I go back to that same theme with me. That just keeps me.
You like a plot. You like a heavy plot. You're not. I thought you'd be like a what do they call the
romance?
The rom-coms or something? I thought you'd be a rom-com guy, Drew.
That ain't me.
I'm just joking with you.
I'm not going to lie. I'll put one of those on, but I usually put it on in the background while I'm doing work because it's just a sit. But I'm also that person that here's my other little fun fact. I'm that person who won't watch a movie twice.
I'm that same way, Christine.
Not me. I like it. I'm watching it again. I'm waiting time. I want to see what I missed. I think I've seen the movie, my guilty pleasure movie, Shooter, with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Because it's such a... The acting is so bad in most of it, right? But it's just a fun movie. Like the plot from start to finish, you know, he falls in love with his former partners, like all the obvious stuff. But then he also shoots a guy's hand off from about 1,000 yards away. And at the end, my favorite scene's at the very end when he gets revenge on everybody in the cabin. And if there's a spoiler here for anybody listening, I apologize. That movie's been out for like 20 years. It comes on every weekend.
It's 2007. Yeah. I look just out of curiosity.
So, we're really close to 20, right? And every time it's on, I'm like, yep. I'm watching, especially on a Friday night if I'm having a bourbon or two. It's a fun one to watch.
The Kate, the girl that's in the movie, her family, I think, I can't remember if they own the Giants or they own a professional football team.
Yes. She's part of the Mirror family. That owns the Giants.
Yeah. Yep. But I'm with you, Christy. I can't, like, I can name on my, I can name on one hand the movies I've watched more than once. Once I've seen it once, unless it's been a super long time, I might watch it again. But I can't stay as, it's probably my lack of attention and my issues that I have that I'm open about, but I just can't watch it. It's not the same.
Same. It could be on the background, but I can't do the full on sit and attention to it. But
fully engaged. That's all right.
To each their own.
Yeah, that's right.
We won't fault you for watching Shooter over and over again every Friday.
Jimmy calls me Rain Man all the time because I focus on things other people.
I do. I'm like, dude, you're being Rain Man right now. Just what do you got going? He's calculating in his head, and I'm like, dude, come on. I want to talk about mountain bikes real quick, and then we'll wrap it up because Jake always tells us we've only got 10 minutes left, and we've got two of that right now, Christine. But just I heard mountain bikes. I've started riding a mountain bike with I've got four kids and three girls and one little boy. And I built a little course on the backside of my farm and we're riding mountain bikes. And I've probably rode it 6, 7, 8 times, but there's a whole world in mountain bikes. How adventurous, how far into it are you? And I'm sure you've got a really good bike that
Jim. One bike? No.
You got multiple bikes. Okay. Okay. Addictive. Yeah.
I'll give you this. When I started, I bought probably ended up being in COVID, but kind of an entry level aluminum bike, 32 pounds. Quickly, I went into a full carbon bike, more race focused. Now I have a full carbon race bike. That's about 21 pounds with pedals and everything on it. Now, does it give you a lot of, cushion? Not really, but it's a race bike. I have multiple. Yeah. I've really found it, you know, it's almost addicting, but to me it's stress relief because it's when you could clear your head when you're riding through the woods at 20 miles an hour, 25 miles an hour, downhill, something like that, and there's trees and rocks and everything else. You need to be able to clear your mind and just get out of your head, or the consequences are great. But it is fun. And you know, I remember riding my bike when I was, you know, that 8, 10-year-old, 12-year-old. And my word, what I believe has come of it is it's a bunch of us who were kids who really liked it, built up these things. And now it's like we made really fancy toys. I live in I live in North Carolina, and you know, the community, the weather, everything's good for it. So I've really been into it. I may have to come see the back end side of your farm and see what you built, Jim.
Yeah, well, we've also got a lake. It's called McDougal Lake, and we built probably, I don't know, 10 to 15 miles of a trail system back there that we run. I got into running a couple years ago, and we do a lot of trail running, but then there's a big mountain bike. It's one of probably the nicest mountain bikes. So if you ever find yourself in Hodgenville, Kentucky, for some reason that only you would be here for, I don't know why. Abraham Lincoln's born here, so you could come see that. But
they've got four restaurants, Christine. They got four restaurants, and they're all fantastic. All good old country food.
It's just a small farming community, but it's about an hour south of Louisville. But we got some really nice trails. I'm at the entry level right now, so I bought a Giant.
Okay.
I paid under $1,000 for it. I quickly figured out I needed new handles on it. I rode it the first time, and the seat, I won't describe what it did to me. So I figured out I needed something different on the seat, and I've accessorized it with a light. We do some light night rides every once in a while, which is pretty fun and cool, but I'm with you. I have way more interest in hobbies than I have time to do my hobbies, but my son and I like to go out and ride mountain bikes together.
Well, the last thing on mountain biking, I wish I was into it many years ago, and I didn't take time off between being a kid and now and doing it. But Bentonville, Arkansas, Walmart headquarters, the Walmart Waltons, did a ton of work, and that is like the mountain bike mecca. So if you ever see, take a look at some YouTube videos and things they do down there, it's just absolutely insane. And the things people do, and you know, 20, 30 foot drops is incredible. I won't be doing that. I mean, I probably top up like four or five feet.
You guys,
I like my legs.
I'm not.
We need to get Drew on a mountain bike, Christine. What do you think?
I've got a mountain bike. I've got a mountain bike. I'm not going too crazy though, because the physics of a man of my stature on two wheels and speed, right? It's the same thing as skiing. It's like you got to be. I got to balance.
Brakes are built for 300 pounds on it, right? That's what you're saying.
I do have a big man bike though. I got one that's rated to like 390 pounds or something silly.
I could see you at the downhill bike park, full face helmet, going up in the lift.
I want to see him in a helmet, Christine. That's what I want. I want the helmet. I want a picture of him on the bike. This first time I've ever heard he's got a mountain bike.
It's in my garage. I'm going to pass it down to Caleb because I don't get to use it that often.
Well, I've enjoyed it. We'll wrap it up. Jake, Christine, thank you so much. This has been one of my favorite conversations. Your perspective, your background, just your answers. I think you did a phenomenal job, and I think our listeners are going to love it. And just, we appreciate you. We appreciate you as a partner, appreciate you as a person. Thank you for what you do with Zion, and just thank you for spending a little bit of time with us today. So we greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you guys for having me. This was fun, and I too appreciate the partnership. It's not always easy, these partnerships, but it's fun, and I know we're all looking out for the same best interest. So really appreciate it, and again, thank you for having me today.